Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Mully and Hall, mornings live at 5 on Sports Radio 670 The Score. 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
Just like any other day that I didn't pitch well, they have to come get the ball. So, I mean, I think people are making a big deal out of it more than me and him are, you know. Like I said, it's just a getting. I don't want to like downplay it to be absolutely nothing, because I mean, obviously, we've been friends for a long time and have that relationship. But anytime, regardless of the spring training, you hit your pitch count, it's never good when they come out there and take the ball from you. So, you know, it's that's the kind of the way I look at it. Not so much him as Rossi.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Tom Thayer in for Mully this morning. And that was John Lester back in spring training 1.0 back in Arizona, when he was talking about David Ross and the dynamic of playing for a guy who was his personal catcher and very trusted teammate and valued friend. And Tom, I think it's been interesting to see how David Ross has evolved into this role, and we haven't seen him even manage a game yet that matters. We've just seen him in these positions of having to speak for the team, be in this leadership capacity, and be a manager when we're so used to being the catcher who was known as Grandpa Rossi and the guy that was as accessible as anybody. And we've seen him now, you know, if it's a politician and he moves into the White House, we wonder if he's going to be presidential. You hear that a lot. Oh, is he presidential? Is David Ross managerial? Does he look like a guy who has made that transition now to that seat in that role for the Cubs? And if you, from your perspective as a former player, as somebody who, you know, I think in football it's a little different, but if you had to look at what that dynamic is and how it has changed, how would you describe the biggest challenge facing David Ross, and what do you think about the way he's handled it so far?
Okay, up until this point, you put a uniform on him, you put him at the end of the bench and stand in wherever corner he wants to hide, and I think he looks the part. However, here's my concern, and it's been a concern since they did bring him on as the manager. So in the 9 years that I'm in the Bears locker room, if I have a problem, if I have a concern, if I have an injury issue that I can't share with anybody else, I would go to a Gary Fensick, a Mike Singletary, Hampton McMichael, and try to tell them about what's ailing me and why I have a hard time getting a stance, or what's hurting me right now and what my concern is. So then I put David Ross back into that same locker room. And, yeah, he was the elder statesman as a player, but when a young Chris Bryant, Anthony Rizzo, any of the guys in this team, they have some type of issue that's maybe bothering them a little bit more than they're telling management, then they vent to David Ross. So now he's got a lot of information that he heard from active players when he was an active player. So now you got Anthony Rizzo that comes in and he's talking about having back issues. Is this something that David Ross already knew about from 3 or 4 years ago? Or some of the ailments that has plagued Chris Bryant in the last year or two, does David Ross know a little bit more about those than Joe Maddon did, or even Theo, or all the guys in the upper management? Because when you're talking about preparing for a contract negotiation or that next level, you don't always tell the people that are making those decisions. You know, every year that I went to the Bears, my back hurt, but I could get through the preseason physical in front of Freddie Kato or whoever the trainer was just because I needed to get through it. You know what? That's my concern, David, is David Ross may have a lot more information about the ailments of these guys from 2-3 years ago, and now he's got to make decisions going forward with the information he already has.
Okay, so in that role, in that context, I think that's an interesting point. So whether he knows about the history of Anthony Rizzo's bad back or somebody else's aching, you know, ankle or shoulder, or maybe John Lester has something that he knows him better than any player he's ever, you know, caught. So now if you are a manager and if you're his teammate, do you push him to a different degree than you would if you are his manager? And that dynamic, that changes because your relationship has changed and you may need him to, from a manager's perspective, go out there and not just Rizzo, but in this example, I guess, you may need a player to play through some pain and not necessarily injury, but to suck it up a little bit more. So, and you may ask him to do that more so than you might as a teammate, or is it the other way around, Tom? Or as a teammate, do you want your buddy to be out there with you? Said, okay, just suck it up. Whereas a manager, you might be looking out for the long term. The dynamic changes because your role changes and the expectations are different now. If you're David Ross and you're looking at somebody who might have, you know, be or is dealing with something like Rizzo might be dealing with.
Well, the buddy thing is over. I mean, yeah, you can have a past relationship that you're congenial with each other, but David Ross is in a position to make decisions to get to the Cubs of the World Series. It's not about making sure that Anthony Rizzo or whomever. I just say that because that's the first name that comes to mind a lot when you talk about the Cubs. Any player out there, he's not making the decision for them. He's making the decision on behalf of the organization. And, you know, Mike Ditka and I, we had very few conversations during my time with the Bears. And it was important decisions that, you know, when he called me into his office or, you know, he had to make the decisions, even, you know, some of the other decisions he had to make according to other personnel while we were there. Mike Ditka was not worried about being my friend. He was concerned about getting to the Bears or the Super Bowl. And I always reminded, because it's the guys telling me, the first meeting he sat in front of these players as a head coach, he says, well, I got some good news and I got some bad news. We are going to go to the Super Bowl. That's the good news. But the bad news is most of you guys won't be here. So, and that's Mike Ditka, the head coach. It's not Mike Ditka, my friend. I never felt like I was friends with Mike Ditka until like 10 years after I was done playing with him. And I remember sitting in a room and I go, you know, coach, I'm finally not intimidated by you. But because I always was, and I always liked that respect. I liked that separation of respect from me as a player and him as a head coach. And I think that's kind of the transformation that some of these guys got to be willing to make and let David Ross make manager decisions and not best friend decisions.
And the perception is that's as big of a challenge for David Ross as it will be to manage his bullpen or to come up with a daily batting order that makes sense or to platoon, you know, the at second base or wherever, whatever position. And Tom, it's curious because back when David Ross was a player, and whether he was on this station or whether I can remember being out at the ballpark and covering that team when he was a member of it, there was a sense of, okay, this guy's going to be a future manager. Oh, and you hear it all the time. Joe Girardi, well, he's going to be a future manager. Guys who have this sort of cerebral approach to the game and get along with pretty much everybody in the clubhouse, they're kind of deemed future managers. And I just wonder, when you look back at your own experiences, because I think we all relate our own experiences to what we're kind of watching now, Ron Rivera on from your era in that locker room turned into a really good NFL head coach, a really strong leader of men. And you look at what he's done at Carolina, and you look at what he's expected to do in Washington, and that was a guy who became a head coach. But you look at Mike Singletary, a guy who you might have thought would have been, you know, the guy from that 85 team and that defense to come out and be the best head coach possible, wasn't a real good head coach. Did that make any sense then, or any more sense then than it does now? Did that surprise you? Because you look at the 85 group And you wonder how many coaches from that group, you know, emerged as guys that were, you know, became really good head coaches.
Yeah, I think there's completely two different personalities between Ron Rivera and Mike Singletary. Ron Rivera came in, even though he was a second-round draft choice, he came in and he had some back issues initially. And then his first contribution was being one of the core players on the special teams, and he was a big-time contributor because I played on kickoff return with him my whole career there. And then as Ron was promoted to a starting opportunity, he was able to develop and capitalize on it. So he took the stages and the different levels to get to become a starting player after the building years early. And then when he did want to become a head coach, he was an unpaid volunteer for a couple of years, and he was not above, you know, he was not above that thinking. And then he was able to earn his position coach and then get into a coordinator, and then we've seen him flourish from there. You know, Mike Singletary got out of football for quite a few years and then wanted to jump right back into the coaching part of it and wanted to be a position coach immediately. And so maybe those years of development that Ron Rivera lived and sometimes suffered through was a better learning experience, how to talk to a player when they come to him and they have a face-to-face in-office conversation. And they're kind of going through some of the same stumbling blocks that Ron went through earlier in his career. So I do think, you know, it's a little bit about how was your time spent in the NFL to get where you got. You know, Mike went from a high draft choice to earning the praise of Buddy Ryan and then becoming the NFL Defensive Player of the Year a couple times. So I think the different roads to success kind of also spells out what's going to happen in their career. And look at, you know, David Ross's career. You know, it's more similar to a Ron Rivera career than it was a Mike Singletary career, although he was part of the World Series winning team.
Anybody from that group, from the 85 group, from your career that did not become a head coach that you thought might have gone down that path?
That's a good question. It's one thing weird about it is when we are playing for the Bears, and I'll talk about my offensive line coach, Dick Stanfeld, a great player, a great coach. He kind of discouraged us to get into coaching because the amount of hours associated to the job, how they were getting paid at that time. He was more encouraging to us to go out there and get a second career of something away from football. Maybe if we are encouraged to get into coaching a little more, some of us would have thought about it, because if you take the history of Jay Hilgenberg throughout his dad's coaching career and playing career, his older brother, his uncle Wally played for 18 years, his younger brother, you know, here's a guy that was set up to be a great coach, but, you know, just the dynamics of it was different back then, and the encouragement was a lot less.
That's interesting, because I would have thought that, you know, you look at some of the guys who were successful off that 85 team as coaches, and you're right, the Leslie Frazier, for example, he's a guy from that era who became a better head coach. I wouldn't have thought that necessarily he jumped out at the time, and yet you look at he's been a pretty successful in the industry. Tom, a lot of people would have looked at you and said, okay, why didn't you go down that road? But you just explained part of the reason why, because you maybe talked out of it at some point in time.
I was, you know, and two, as you look at some of these assistant coaches, and they move around every 1 to 2 to 3 years. And, you know, I'm the youngest in my family, and I have a lot invested in my mom and dad at the time and my whole family. And I was always, you know, I wanted to be supportive of them. I did, and I was worried about moving all over the country. However, if you look back at it and you think of, you know, what might have been, I would have probably been, you know, more encouraged to get into coaching. You know, and Leslie Frazier, he was not too big for anything. He went to Trinity and started a program there and was able to show University of Illinois then, and then these other programs, that this guy, he was a dedicated coach. And I think that's the reluctancy about some of back then as hiring ex-players as coaches, because when you got to start putting in 18-hour days throughout the course of the season, some players aren't built for that after they had a long playing career.
He's Tom Thayer. He's in for Mike Mulligan today, and this hour is brought to you by Cars for Kids. Call 1-877-CARS4KIDS. Cars for kids. What is the mindset of an NFL player as they prepare for training camp July 28th? We will talk about that next. Molly and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score.
Well, my gut feeling at this point, and talking to a lot of people around the league, obviously at Fox, is that the NFL is going to push the envelope as far and as hard as they can to play football. And I think the thinking is that, one, there's going to be instances where players get affected with the COVID-19. Okay, if that happens, it's got to be the next guy up, but we have to try to keep our games going, keep our season going, and keep our product going.
Molly and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. That was the voice of Dave Wannstedt, who joined us last week talking about the expectations for a normal, as normal as can be, NFL training camp, which is right around the corner, July 28th. Tom Thayer in for Mike Mulligan today. And Tom, we heard from Wani last week. We know that on Saturday, the Texans and the Chiefs rookies are expected or scheduled to report to camp. They have to take COVID-19 tests 48 hours in advance. They have yet to receive any sort of direction from the league. We know that on July 28th, that's sort of the universal reporting date. The Bears are anticipating reporting to Halas Hall on that day. I just wonder how realistic that is. I wonder if there would be some, if it'd be wiser to delay the reporting date back 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, however long you think it will take to buy you some time to have more clarity about what to expect. If you're a player, if you're a coach, heck, if you're an executive, how are you preparing for July 28th in Lake Forest, if in our local context, because there's so much uncertainty surrounding the situation?
Well, you know, Dave Wannstedt, he has his hand on the pulse of football, both college and pros, and he talks to a lot of different people. So it's, you know, it's encouraging to say the NFL wants this thing to go. And I do think they have different plans in place, and I think that's just the smart way to go about it, because in the onset of this, you don't know how things are going to go. And if you have a disruption in time or personnel or testing, then, you know, you may have to, you know, push back the start a little bit. So I just think there's so much unknown, and you can only take your next step either in a positive direction or prevention of what's going on. But, you know, David, I got to tell you, I always say this, and I grew up in a working class family. If I'm 23 to 25 years old, I'm probably going to go and I'm going to do anything they ask me to do. I'm not going to have, and it's probably naive to say this, because as a 23 or 24 year old, a hopeful, aspiring professional athlete, you don't think the same as most people do. And so, If that's me, if this is my chance, if this is my opportunity, I'm going to be ready and I'm going to take every advantage of it. If they shut us down, then they're shutting everybody down.
Two questions come to mind when you say that, Tom. Number one is, okay, so when you look at your 23 to 25 years old and you're Tom Thayer and you're from a working class background and it's 1983 or it's 1984, how different is it now than it was then in terms of all the voices in your head and all the advice you're getting from your agents, your support staff, your friends? The web is wider and the circle is wider around you. I think that's the first thing that comes to mind, what you think. And secondly, how different is it for a football player, if it is at all, to consider these opt-out scenarios than it would be for a Major League Baseball player? Because is there a different mindset in a football locker room that exists in a major league or a baseball clubhouse?
Yeah. I mean, what's your financial position in life, David? If you're out there and your occupation is a professional football player, then you have a period of time within your life that you have to try to make as much money as you can in order to support yourself, your family, and hopefully create a better existence down the road in the rest of your life. So, you know, for example, When the Oakley came out with this new helmet mask that's designed to protect the players,
yep,
and the first guy to come up and say, "Oh, I'm against it," is J.J. Watt. Listen, listen, on the world side of life, I admire everything you've done, especially when they had the whole horrific situation down in Houston and you raised all that money for the good of the people that need it. If you have a $100 million contract and you say you're opting out because you feel claustrophobic when you put on a protective device around your mouth to protect the other players, I find that to be a bunch of baloney, because you missed half the games of every season over the last 4 or 5 years. So, again, David, I'm making a claim for myself in the way I was raised and never gained that, you know, financial lifetime generational security. So decisions are made depending upon what your financial status is at this time.
I could not agree with you more. That is a bunch of baloney, because if you are J.J. Watt, I guess because he is the biggest name who has spoken on this and shared his opinion about the Oakley mouth shield, the new helmet that is going to be tried out by all 32 teams, designed by engineers and doctors, designed to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. If you're going to say and can be worried about whether or not your league is going to protect your health and safety, and they come up with a way to protect your health and safety, why would you complain about it? Why would you talk about being claustrophobic? And why wouldn't you just say, okay, we will see how this feels, and we applaud everyone for trying to do what's in the best interest of the health and safety of the players? That makes all the sense in the world, Tom. And I think that if that's the new reality they're dealing with, it's certainly – playing uncomfortably with a new helmet is much better than not playing at all.
Right, but it's also what's your financial status? And you know, I tell this story because it's just happened in an instant. And it was I probably told you this before. We were walking out the door at kickoff one time, and I was walking next to Walter Payton. And I looked at Walter and I said, "Walter, why are you still so great?" And he says, "Because I'm not rich." And we walked out, kickoff, we played the game. And that's just an answer in an instant, right, and in an emotional second, right, of trying to capture the greatness of the greatest, most determined player in the history of the league to me, from a young kid watching him and then being a teammate with him and being friends after the fact. But when I listen to the statements made by J.J. Watt, I it's destructive, because what was his guaranteed money in his last contract? It's enormous. So this guy, if he never puts on another cleat again, he's financially set for 5 lifetimes.
And let's take what he said on his merit just to kind of explore it. So in fairness, when you are a player and you get used to certain, you know, certain things, your comforts, what makes you, you know, productive, and you're also, there's some rituals involved that you really like. Equipment comes into that equation, and how long does it take to adjust to a new helmet? And could there be ways? I think it was Antonio Brown. Remember when he went through the whole thing with the Raiders and his helmet, and he's kind of a flake, and maybe that's a bad example, but it does take time to adjust to new equipment. Do you think that there's anything in terms of, is there anything valid in that complaint or concern that it would take time to get used to this new helmet that would be used to kind of protect players?
No. You know, it takes every year that you go back and you start the season again, it takes you 3 or 4 days to get comfortable within your equipment. It would be the same thing with a mouth shield. And, you know, as weird as I am about football, I have one of my Notre Dame football helmets at home. So when the COVID started, I was taking these different shields and I was putting them inside the face mask of the helmet. I was putting the helmet on and I was just saying, wow, could this something like this be invented? And yeah, obviously it has. It's not going to be a distraction. You're still breathing. It's not like, have you ever seen the apparatuses or the devices the MMA fighters train with now, when they cover their mouth and they limit the amount of oxygen they can get? Yeah, if you were asked to do something like that, okay, now you're talking about an sufficient supply of oxygen going into your system to get the job done. But when you're talking about a face shield that's protecting you from the other person and vice versa, man, wouldn't you be a stand-up to the plate veteran at that point and say, I admire what the NFL is trying to do to protect all of us, not just me?
One would hope, Tom, and I have to ask you, you open this door, how shiny is your Notre Dame helmet still all these years later?
No, it's not. It's beat the heck. You know what, Dave, too, is you used to get these battle scars on the front of your helmets that you never wanted to remove them because that was a big-time collision, something you always remember. And I do have hits and dings in this helmet that I remember when I got them from back, you know, in those college days. Because a helmet is something that you don't want to change every year. You kind of get it to fit for you. It becomes comfortable after a period of time. They refurbish it after every season. And so, you know, it's just a piece of equipment that feels like a comfortable kicking shoe.
Number 64 from Joliet. He's Tom Thayer. He's in for Mike Mulligan today. We all think the NFL will start, but will it finish? We will ask Ross Tucker that and more next on Mullen Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
I am. I really am. They're really trying to do it the right way. You know, we're going through a lot of conversations with the Player Association. You know, the league and them are working very diligently to make sure they put, you know, all the safety precautions in place. They really do. I mean, this really is about making sure. You know, this really is about player safety and coaches and everybody. So I think they're trying to do things the right way.
Molly and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Tom Thayer in for Mike Mulligan today. That was the voice of Ron Rivera talking about the health and safety protocols the NFL is going to have to enforce and have in place before training camp on July 28th. That was with McNeil and Parkins a couple weeks ago. On the line now is Radio.com Sports Insider Ross Tucker. Insider calls are brought to you by Pennzoil. Motor oils brought to you by and made by natural gas. The proof is in the Pennzoil. He joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Good morning, Ross. How are you doing this morning?
You know what? I am doing pretty well, David. Thank you for having me. Good to talk with you guys.
Good to talk with you, too. Tom Thayer joins us, and obviously you guys know what it takes to get ready for an NFL training camp, Ross, and you know the mindset and how the clock starts to tick down. You look at the calendar differently in mid-July than maybe you do at the beginning of the month, and certainly in June. What's your expectation, and how realistic is to, in your mind, to expect an NFL training camp to begin on time at the end of this month?
Yeah, well, first of all, David, I can tell you, that 4th of July was always so bittersweet, man. On the one hand, I was usually somewhere having a good time with my friends or family, but I also knew that 3 weeks away, my ass was grass, as they say, and we were going to have to get to training camp. It was going to be rough. You know, we'll see. They're negotiating the next couple days. I remain bullish on them starting training camp on time, on them starting the season on time. The reason why I say that is I don't know what pushing it back a week or two or three, I don't really know what that accomplishes, number one. And number two, unlike college football, you know, especially for the player's perspective, there's nothing but risk at this point, right? I mean, yes, there is the risk of getting sick and COVID-19, and we all recognize that. But the economic risk for these players is very real as well. You know, I'm a guy that played 7 years. I think I made the minimum all but two of those 7 years. And so I would be very anxious to make sure we had a season, to make sure I was playing, because for me, based on what I know now, I feel like, you know, that year would be worth the risk to me to make sure I was able to continue to try to get that financial head start for my family.
Hey, Ross, it's nice to talk to you. And, you know, Ross, I started my career in the USFL. We had no preseason games. Can the NFL do it now and maybe forever? Or what is your, in your time, what's your thought process on the need for preseason games?
That's interesting, Tom. You know, I never knew that. I didn't know you guys didn't have preseason games in the USFL. So I think everyone in life is probably a little bit biased based on their experience, right? And so for me, I had a couple injuries during my rookie camp, so I only got to play in two of the four preseason games. But that's how I made the team. I mean, you know, I was supposed to be the backup left tackle and play in the second half. Chris Samuels got hurt on the fifth play. And Marty Schottenheimer looked at me and was like, get in there. And so I ran in on the field, and it was like Jeff George and Steven Davis and Michael Westbrook. I hadn't had one snap with any of those guys. And I'm going against Patrick Kearney and all these guys for the starters for the Falcons. And you know what? I held my own. And then I broke my hand in that game, came back for the last preseason game, and just kind of threw my cast around and hit people with it and made the team as the ninth O-lineman, as an undrafted rookie. So I really do think you need at least two preseason games. And I'm surprised that the players are pushing against this as much as they are. I understand why they would go from four preseason games to two preseason games. Although even there, guys, my argument is the two they're eliminating are essentially the first one and the last one. The only guys that play in the first one and the last one are the bottom 40, 45, maybe 50 guys on the roster anyway. And because they missed OTAs and minicamp and everything, every single one of those guys, because I was one of those guys several times, would raise their hand and volunteer to play in those games. So it's like you're eliminating games to protect, I guess, guys that they want to be out there. They want that film. They want that opportunity to earn a roster spot or a practice squad spot on that team or elsewhere. But I think it's a little bit weird that the players are pushing against even playing two preseason games as much as they are. I understand their thought process that the games don't count. And, you know, that's not really when they're getting their big salary. But they're not going to, I mean, the guys that are in those negotiations, they're not going to have to be the ones playing that much in those games. It's mainly going to be the young guys. And with all the new procedures and protocols that they're going to have because of the virus, I would think that the guys would want to go through that once or twice and have an idea of what it is. Plus, you know, everybody I talked to Dr. David Chow, the former Chargers team doctor, last week on the Ross Tucker podcast. And he said, you're more likely to get the virus during the 6 days in the facility leading up to the game than the game itself, when you're outside and you're having, you know, 2 or 3 second interaction at a time during a play. And so I think that's an ask that the players are really fighting for that I don't think is as important as some of the other issues at hand.
We're talking with Radio.com Sports Insider Ross Tucker here on Mully and Haw. Tom Thayer in for Mully today. And Ross, among your stops in your 7-year NFL career, two of them were in Washington for the NFL team there, and that's the big national story. The decision announced yesterday, Daniel Snyder will change the nickname after being pressured by corporate sponsors and buckling to that pressure. And I refer to it as the right decision, even if it was maybe for the wrong reasons. It was a long time coming. As someone who played in that environment and represented that franchise, what are your thoughts as this sort of unfolds this week?
You know, the first thing I would tell you is I grew up outside of Philly as an Eagles fan, so it was kind of weird to play for the Washington Redskins and the Dallas Cowboys, by the way. But I never really looked at it as anything other than a football team name growing up. And then even when I played for the Redskins, I don't remember people talking about it that much. But over the last 10 years or so, you know, I've obviously learned a lot more about it. And even just seeing an email that I got that talked about the negative impact that it has had on a lot of Native American youth, I thought was really interesting. You know, I guess the one thing I've always wondered is I've actually met and had people on the radio call up that are Native American that have said that it's a source of pride, that they like that the football team is a Native American team, and that their concern is if we get rid of the Cleveland Indians and Atlanta Braves and Kansas City Chiefs and any Native American mascots, that, you know, people will almost forget their heritage and what they did. So I think it's the right decision, David. I agree with you. I think it evidently has caused a lot of people a lot of pain. I've always wanted to know, I'd love to have like a really good study I took a polling class in college, right? Because I've seen various polls, but then people say the polls are flawed. I'd love to know how many Native Americans, because really I don't care what other people think, right? I care about the affected group. What percentage of Native Americans are really upset by it? What percentage don't really care? What percentage actually kind of liked it? And we could go from there. I think, you know, what has spoken loud and clear is that enough Native Americans really are bothered by it, that it was time for a change, and I'm totally fine with that.
Hey, Ross, you know, when you think about the Chicago Bears here, and I don't know all about your time in the NFL, but I know it was rarely, maybe to never in my time, a promoted quarterback competition months out of training camp, and that's been kind of the topic here between Mitchell Trubisky and Nick Foles. What's your feeling about a promoted quarterback competition this far in advance?
Well, and you know, there's a couple things there, Tom, right? So, number one, if there's no preseason games, what are we really judging the guys on? I mean, are we judging them based on how they perform in practice when they're wearing red jerseys, or what do they wear down there? Orange, whatever it is, where you can't hit them. Like, what are we judging them on? I mean, you know, Tom, and I know, there are guys, quarterbacks, that are awesome when they have that you can't hit me jersey on. It's just a different mindset. It's just different. They know they can't get hit, and they look awesome when they go out there and it's live. It's a little bit different. So I already think it's pretty difficult. But then if there's no preseason games or even only two, I think it makes the competition difficult. The other thing is, I look at my 7 years, and I'm sure you guys have gone over it. David, you're on the radio every day, so I'm sure you talk about it. I'm sure there's some guys. I'm sure there are. But I can't think of very many teams that went into training camp with a quarterback competition and went on to have really successful seasons. And I know, David, you could probably give me an example right now, but off the top of my head, I think about the teams I was on and when I was a player, and even since then, and it doesn't usually work out, right? I mean, you know, they might pick one of the guys. He might play okay, but I can't think of very many of those teams being the type of teams that actually go to the playoffs and do some damage when they had uncertainty at the quarterback position in August.
It's a great point, and there's not a great example that comes to mind, and we've been talking about it for several months here, Ross, and I found it fascinating, one of the points that you made on a recent podcast. We talk about the quarterback competition. We talk about Nick Foles versus Mitch Trubisky, and you point out that a new strategy in the light of this COVID-19 era that we're living in this COVID-19 environment that they're entering the next training camp, that you would keep your first two quarterbacks separate because you wouldn't want them to contaminate each other. You would want to make sure that they were almost quarantined from each other. Is that feasible, do you think?
Well, so I think it starts really with whatever the rules are, right? And I it's funny you mention this, because I had James Franklin, Penn State's head coach, on the Ross Tucker podcast yesterday, and he actually referenced this, where he doesn't want to have his two quarterbacks together. I think in college, and I don't know what the NFL rules are going to be, but it's one of those deals where if you are exposed to someone that tests positive, or even if you're exposed to someone who was around someone that tested positive, a lot of these times, a lot of these conferences, they're going to have a 10-day or a 14-day quarantine. So I do think, especially in the NFL where they even have less quarterbacks on the team, I don't know, do you want to have Trubisky and Foles in the same meeting room? And then, I don't know, let's say the quarterback coach has it. So then, you know, I don't know what the rules are the NFL is going to have. Do they test the guy, and if they test negative, then they're okay? Or do they say, nope, you guys were both around the quarterback coach. You both have to quarantine for 2 weeks. And so, you know, we're watching Sunday Night Football, and it's the Bears and Tyler Bray against Aaron Rodgers and the Packers. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know exactly, Dave. I don't know that they've announced. I think they're still working on what those rules, protocols are,
right,
in terms of your exposure, if someone tests positive, how long you have to quarantine, et cetera. But based on those rules, whatever they end up being, you better believe that some of these teams are going to have strategies and are going to keep some of these guys away from each other. I don't know if it's, you know, the first string O-line. You know, literally, Franklin said to me yesterday that their current plan is to have the coaches on the field for 5 hours and to have half the team practice for 2.5, the other team practice for 2.5, just to keep some separation, some space, and in case, you know, there is an outbreak of sorts, that the other guys are clear. I guess my thought would be, if there is an outbreak of sorts that it affects a lot of guys, I'm not sure they're playing anyway, but that was sort of the point he was making. I mean, these are real conversations that coaches are having right now, trying to figure out what their COVID strategy should be, if you will.
Great stuff, Ross. Appreciate your time this morning.
All right, take care, guys.
Thanks, Ross.
That was Radio.com Sports Insider Ross Tucker. Insider calls are brought to you by Pennzoil. Motor oils made from natural gas. The proof is in the Pennzoil. Will there be a college football season? Should there be a college football season? We will talk to Tom Thayer. Ask him that question next. Mullenhaw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.